Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. You've got Renee, and with me I've got my two co-hosts.
I was wondering what she was going to say there, Tony.
I was waiting, yeah.
Hello. Hi. Craig.
Hello, Renee.
Hello, Tony.
Hello, Renee.
And we have a special guest today from, where are you? In Netherlands, is that right?
Serge? Yes, I'm in the Netherlands, yes. Serge Bowen.
From the Netherlands, we've got Serge Beaumont, who is and has been for quite a while been working with Zebia. So welcome.
Yes, thank you. Nice to be here.
So I know that you sort of came up, I've actually seen your work for quite a while, and Zebia is really well known in the Agile community over in Europe. So how about you just kick us off a little bit in the podcast, tell a little bit, everyone who's listening, a bit about yourself and a bit about Zebia.
Yeah, sure. So as far as myself is concerned, my career went off strangely because I studied to be a mechanical engineer, but I also had a lot of affinity for computers and programming and stuff like that. So I pushed my CV to three mechanical engineering companies and three IT companies, and I ended up to be hired by an IT company, and that's, you know, my career went that direction. So I did, like, so my background is software and architecture, etc. So I was a programmer for 13 years, and you know, how that career goes, you kind of become the tech lead of a team, etc. And I had a lot of interest in also, you know, making sure that things work, because I was always frustrated with the fact you can program yourself until you're blue in the face, but still projects fail because of all the stuff around the programming. So I've always been the type of guy who then goes out and just puts his claws into the environment, because I wanted to make sure things would work. And that's the way it goes. You become the tech lead, so you're only responsible stuff around the programming, and a lot of that is the process, and you kind of slowly move into it. So around 2007, I was already working with extreme programming, and so kind of was into the Agile world. It's like really old school. And I also think I made one of the oldest unit testing frameworks by that time. Was like for Delphi. I was programming Delphi at the time, and there was nothing.
Wow. Whoa.
Yeah, it was like old school, right? Hey.
It's real 4GLs for the win.
Yeah. Woo-hoo. Exactly. So I think, as far as I know, at least, because it was Ron Jeffries who had this X-Programming website, and there was all these testing frameworks there. There was nothing for Delphi at the moment, so I created one, and I put it online. So there was, like, for me, the Agile started actually with extreme programming. And then at some points, I kind of switched into full-time Agile consultancy, because the company said, well, I don't want you for your technical knowledge, I just want you for the Agile knowledge. And then kind of my career went from there. And I've been doing, like, full-time Agile ever since. I've also had a stint now as a manager for 3 years, like the past 3 years. But my love for consultancy was just too much. Like, I missed it, right? So I switched back again. But it was very valuable to me, because I think there's a level of empathy you need, especially if you're going to be working with Agile, that you also need to empathize with what a manager is, what does, what's your world, what are the worries and fears and things you encounter. And I learned a lot from that. So I'm very happy that I had the experience. As far as Xebia is concerned, Xebia, I think, was founded in 2001. Also like a pure play IT company. That's also kind of when I entered, we were just pure play, like IT Java, like Java was the thing, right? We were just a Java house. And the way our company grows is actually pretty special, in the sense that we always maximize to, like, the cells of about 40 people. And then when it gets too large, there tends to be split offs. Like and I was one of those, one of them, like nowadays is a big data, and like data analysis, data science is one of them. Based test automation, everything around that is one, security. So we have these groups that kind of split off, and Agile was one of them. And that happened somewhere around that same time, I think around 2006, 2007. And all of a sudden there was this cluster of people, about eight at the time, who got together and said, you know, what's our identity is actually more around this Agile thing than around the architects that we normally are. So the beginning, the initial, like, coaches that we had were all came out of the technical background, very much software guys. And then as we grew, now we're 30, 35 or so. Kind of it goes up and down a bit. We're at that level now. And I think the reason, maybe the claim to fame, as far as we can say that for Xebia, is that we were a first mover, which we tried to be. And I think what was powerful is that we had, at a very early time, we had this cluster of coaches, like 8, 9 immediately, who could work together, who could learn from each other, whereas most of the other field, like at that time especially, was all like single people, like just the contractors, etc. So we made this block, right, of people who could help each other and learn. And I think one of the interesting things about what I really like, I mean, in the 1st of June, actually, I will be with the company for 15 years. So when I joined it, it was 25 people, and now we're like over 2,000 or whatever. So I've been with the company for a long time. And I've also learned a lot about culture from, well, my own company, is that how strong culture can be, and how strong, like, the cultural underpinnings, if you really make sure that the human connections is there, that just you can just handle about anything. And one of the foundational processes that we have is what we call the Xebia Knowledge Exchange, the XKE, which is where every other Tuesday, everybody comes together from 4 in the evening until 9 in the evening. With between 6 and 7, there's dinner, everybody together. And then we have these slots. So there's people present things, etc. And it used to be like when we were 25, there was just one track. And then you notice that we became too big, so the conversations were not possible. So it became 3 tracks. And then we became larger still. And now it's like, all of them, there's like maybe 20 tracks at the same time. So we basically have like this mini conference every other Tuesday.
Wow.
Plus dinner, right? So, and you notice, because we know each other so well, and we've worked each other, so it's just so easy to get at your colleagues, to get knowledge. You know who's who, you know what everybody knows, and the willingness of everybody to help each other is super high. And that's, I think, been our power, just with anything. Of course, we're a company who makes mistakes and we don't do everything right, but I think that's been one of our secret weapons, so to speak.
Out of curiosity, are they, in these sessions, are people talking about sort of like the work that they've delivered, or is it more how they've delivered, or combination of both?
Anything. Right. Literally anything goes.
So it could be Game of Thrones, how the final ending should have happened.
Yes, indeed. Because one of the things that's happened is that sometimes at the end of whatever during a show, I think that doesn't happen during XKE, but it was organized, actually, by the way. It was organized to everybody together watch Game of Thrones in our, like, our big... but there was... the point is that I think simply anything goes, but the reason people go there is something will always have a professional connection. You can simply trust that. You don't need to put any rules in place. People will always present or ask for things that have some connection to their professional life. Now, this can go all over the place. So we've also had like things on a personal level. So for instance, I had a colleague who has this meditation, because he noticed that meditation for him helped him a lot to survive his professional life. So he did something about that. Personally, I've had I had a burnout in 2011. And just around the end of the year, I shared all my learnings. And a colleague before me also shared his learnings on a burnout. There's people who do kind of things that kind of related to their hobby. Anything goes, really. And that's, I think, also the power, is that it is really, truly by the people, for the people. And the culture is such that we don't need to, pull people in. Like, could you talk about this? Could you talk about that? It's actually one of the factors people want to work for the company, because we always invite them to the knowledge exchange, and like everybody comes in and goes like, wow, I want to be a part of this, right? So you kind of self-filter for this.
And Xebia was one of those organizations that was involved in the early days of ING and the transformation that they did.
Yeah,
that
was us. It was us. I mean, ING was us. I mean, there's, and of course, it's not just us, in the sense that there's a lot of other companies who had contributions and a lot of coaches that are not like part of Xebia that I really respect, who have also had a tremendous, like, there's a whole community of people who've done the ING transformation that I know and respect, who are not all Xebia, but definitely there was a group of six people or so who formed the foundation of the transition and all the ideas behind it. So you could say that those six were kind of like the architects behind everything. Mm. And this big fundamental decision was made to kind of to follow the Spotify model and shaping it and customizing it, etc., and doing all the coaching for all the tribes, etc. That was like, yeah, that was my colleagues. And some of them now work for ING. One of them works for ING, as far as I know. And that was one of the bigger transitions. We've done other ones that we were involved in, but I think that was one. It was an interesting one in the sense that we really did it from start to finish.
Brilliant. Our viewers may be able to, well, our listeners may be able to see it, but I'm mightily impressed. So we have to mention it. A, with the man cave. Brilliant man cave. Yes, and then secondly, we've done a lot of podcasts in a lot of different locations, but that's got to be one of the best microphone setups I've seen in a while.
Yeah. Well, about the man cave. So if the podcast, I assume people cannot see this. So on one end, there is my board game collection. I have a pretty sizable one. I'm over 200 now, and I'm going towards 250. You don't see is that this cupboard here is actually, that's actually only one section. You have to multiply that by six to get the whole cupboard. So that's pretty, and on the other hand, like here on this side, on my left side, there is the science fiction book collection, because of course I'm an avid, as a true geek.
Yeah, I could see the Raymond Feist books there.
Yeah, so I have all these things. And of course the guitar back here, like my classic guitar, and actually one of the things I asked for the 15 years will be, and I want a bass guitar. Because bass.
There we go. That's I started playing bass in bands, so we've got a connection there.
Yeah. So that's the So this is really indeed. It's funny that you call it a man cave because that's what I call it myself. This is actually the garage.
It's very obvious.
I call it a man cave as well.
You could park a car in this space.
Yeah.
And it has a full dining table here, like just next to me. With I don't know if you know the game Gloomhaven, but it's set up there, and I can just keep it there because it's just a massive big game. I am a true geek. I must admit, indeed.
Ah. And the geek shall rule.
He wants to know about the audio setup, by the way, right?
Yeah, the audio setup. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, I have a colleague of mine called Lars Bonema, who's like a magic guy on the audio stuff. This thing is the Rode PodMic. What's nice about it is that it has a shock filter and a pop filter built in. So that's super cool. And the Focusrite Solo is the thing it connects into. That's actually the whole setup, right? It's not even that much. It has a boom, the mic, and the Focusrite. And they've really served me well. I mean, I'm super happy with it. Oh, and by the way,
we won't have to do any levelation on that.
it's a super nice mic.
Yeah. Craig, I think you had a question. Hmm.
Yeah, I actually wanted to go back to the knowledge thing you're talking about before. So I enjoyed the man cave, but I want to go back to agile topics because this is not the man cave revolution, Tony.
Yeah. Come on, you didn't let it go.
But yeah, it is pretty impressive. I guess because you are a consultant, what's the reaction to from people when you know the investment that Xebia puts into that? Bringing people together because everyone says cool, but the reality is, I'm sure for a lot of organizations that you consult to, that doesn't happen. So, what's the secret sauce that of the culture in Xebia that that's got past that? This is just but that's 2 hours a week that we could be doing real work kind of a thought.
It is because. I think several things. One is that there is a true belief with our director and like Dan Tennessee, who is our original, our main CEO. He has always believed this thing, and he had to be convinced by another of my colleagues, Mark van Holstein, who is actually the originator of the idea. And he also still works for Xebia, and he still had to convince our director. And the anecdotes about that is that when Mark told Dan about, okay, this is the XKE, this is the idea, we all come together, etc. And then, so Dan said, like the true CEO is, like, what do I get out of this? And Mark told him, it's going to be more than you ever expected, but nothing you ever expected. So it's and that's nice. That's crucial to the relationship that those two men have, is that Dan then trusted Mark and got like, okay, you know, let's see where this goes. And I think one of the secrets also is you must have leadership that truly believes in culture as a powerful thing, right? So Dan loves, like, he loves to go to a nice restaurant. He loves, like, living life in a good way. He loves culture and connections, that kind of thing. So he really appreciates it when he sees people around him kind of being happy, etc., and recognizes that, and always has. As far as to our customers is concerned, is that we basically say, look, yes, we are more expensive than other people, like, you know, not super much, but we are more expensive. And this XKE, I mean, it means that generally, say every other Tuesday, somebody will have to leave at 3 o'clock in the evening, and then they're at, you know, they'll start with us at 4 o'clock. So basically out of those weeks, we actually have to invest, because it's like a revenue we're not making, of at least 2 hours for the whole company per week. This costs us quite a lot of money, but we really believe it is, because we've known and seen it to be our power. So what we always tell our customers is, you will be here, discussed here, right? It will be you won't just get this only consultant. You'll get the whole brain tank behind it, with all these colleagues who can help this consultant to do the best they can, or ask questions, or be a better consultant. The reason we can ask these high rates is because of this very reason. And if customers still complain, and they generally don't, actually, but if they still complain, that customer actually has self, you know, filtered them from us, right? Because it's like, if you have a customer who just wants the cheapest people you can get, period. Those are generally those are generally not the best people to work for anyway. So, but in practice, it gets respected. It gets, at least as far as my experience is concerned, it is respected, is actually realized. And of course, what we do is also we invite them over. Like, you want to come see? Come over. I mean, it's, in that sense, it's open. And then people see what's happening and the buzz, and they go like, okay, this is something different. I think the other component to it is that, and that is indeed a big difference between our culture and other companies' culture, is that normally in these type of knowledge exchange things, it's very hard to get people to bring up a topic, right? It's really hard. People like, you know, could you do a thing? And in our case, it's never a problem. Like the app that we use to open it up, basically anybody can see it. Like, it's xke.xebia.com. Like, you can just see the agenda. It's always open, and people can just enter their sessions there. And it's there is often more sessions than we can handle. Now with COVID, of course, it's difficult. We've had to limit it to from 7 o'clock until later. So effectively, we can only do one session, because there's so many people, colleagues who are home and have to work with their kids, put the kids to bed, etc. So, you know, that in that sense, we're struggling a bit. Yeah, I see a hand going up. But I think in our case, it is a combination of having hired the very people who would love such a thing. That is one. The other is, I mean, the food you get every knowledge exchange is good. It is massively, I mean, it's restaurant quality, because often it's the very restaurants in Hilversum, where our head office is, who actually serve it. There is a ton of work put in the presentation, etc. So you don't come there and then get, like, you know, just a bit of bread and just, you know, a pizza or whatever. No. This is good food, because this is also one of those things. If you want to go there, you want to, you know, feel cared for. You're giving up your evening, so you want to go there kind of basically to load up the batteries again. And so it gets that effect, because everybody knows it's a bit of a social thing, and we have a bar which is open. You can just, you know, you can just take all the booze you want. There's no rules that, you know, there's refrigerators. You could just open up the refrigerator and take out ice creams, anything you want. Like, there's there's a bit of a home feel and a party feel, not a party feel, but like a homecoming feel to it. That makes also that really a social event just as much as it is a knowledge exchange event. And it's obviously being invested in. And I think the final component would be the way the company has grown its culture, that there is a bit of a social pressure to contribute. Because, well, you know, we're supposed to be the best. We're supposed to be, you know, trying to be the top consultancy in the country, at least. And so, you know, what are you contributing? And it's not something people like directly ask each other, but there is like one of our biggest problems in Xebia is imposter syndrome. Actually, one of the things my role tends to be a lot, being one of the old guys, is walking up to somebody and go like, you know, you didn't do a talk, you know, for a while. You know, I did this and that. Yeah, but I thought about this, but people probably will know. And my answer is no, awesome, do it. And it's like kind of a bit of a leg up that people need just to start presenting. I hope I have summarized it correctly. But those are to me kind of the component parts of what makes our XKE the XKE.
Well, awesome. And I know when we talked earlier prior to kicking off the recording, you mentioned that you have a different perspective on story maps. I found that incredibly intriguing because, you know, for a while I've been doing story maps like trees as opposed to how they're traditionally done. So you're the first person I've ever met that has a different perspective aside from myself. Tell us a bit more around how you think about them.
Yeah, so and I have checked this both with Jeff Sutherland and Jeff Patton. I mean, Jeff Patton coined the whole thing, right? Because it felt to me like that I was the only one driving on the other side of the road and then going, look, you are all driving on the wrong side of the road, not me. So it felt a bit lonely. So I checked and I've really thought this through. The fact of the matter is that story maps in the structure, right, there is the... So on the top, you put a bunch of stickies or you have like this flow, right? This
the backbone, yep.
The backbone, indeed. I call it the same, indeed. And what happens is that then the stories under the columns, under the like the headers of the columns, those headers become the epics. Every single tool in the market does that, which is wrong. Because if you look at what a story map is, it is you're trying to slice end-to-end through that process, right? You're trying to kind of create a version. So if you have four steps A, B, C, and D, then if you want, if or it's like a web shop and it has like, you know, I can search for stuff, I can I get a listing of the things I searched for, I can look at the details, I can buy. You know, let's say that's
the kind of experience or the journey, yep.
That's the journey. So then people will make the search screen an epic, and then we'll make the detail stuff an epic, which makes no sense because it's not a unit of delivery. Because if you kind of cluster your stories kind of to a higher level, that also should be a backlog, right? That's actually one of the things I see the most is that when people indeed think in terms of a tree structure, when they use Azure DevOps, when they use Jira, they will use the higher levels as categories. So they will say everything around the back end, like an epic could be back end stories. I've seen that the stuff like that, or everything related to something, which is understandable because that's the way we build up our directory structures, right? For instance, if you're just on your laptop, you'll have a directory structure within which you categorize stuff, and then you put your documents in there. But story maps are different. So what you have is that if I want to do something new in my web shop, basically like selling bananas, then I'll have to cut across the process and go like, okay, do I need to do something in the search screen? Yeah, okay, let's do that. I have to be able to search for bananas or for the color yellow or whatever. And then in the listing, do I need to do something there? No, nothing there. Okay, fine. Do I need to do something in the detail screen? Yes, because banana-related details have to be built in. And so the higher level item that connects all these is in the horizontal axis, not in the vertical axis. And none of the story mapping tools do that. They never kind of take a sticky at the left side and say, this is the higher level item, which represents cutting across to, you know, the whole process and making a simple version of that process.
So no real minimal viable product version.
Yeah, and even then, my experience, because I've created a story mapping game a long time ago with a colleague, and where we try to build up kind of like a story map based on little cards. My experience with that has been is that actually what I call a slice, because it's a smaller level than a minimum viable product. Because it may take multiple slices to actually build up your minimum viable product. You tend to need, like say, let's say that process, the first slice is really like your walking skeleton, like the 0.1 version that nobody will want to use, but it works, so you can test it and you can look at it. You tend to have to build up multiple slices like that before you can call an MVP. So to me, an MVP is a bigger thing than just a slice. And a slice has no hard or fast rule. It could mean that to cut across your process, it could be that it's so small it takes you like right. within a sprint you could do it. It could
it's
be
a
so
steel
difficult.
Thread for process.
Yeah, you call it a steel thread.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like other people call it tracer bullet, right? Something like a Or a steel thread. Yeah, I think we. I guess I know what you mean, right? It's like a skeleton. You hang it on. It keeps the connection between all these things. Yeah. I think that's a good way to say it. And so, you know, building that up, and it's nice if the slices map onto a sprint. It's nice because it's like it's convenient if the mapping is there, but it's definitely not. It's not required. So my experience, you know, mostly people need to build up like 5 or 6 of these slices, building up the product as they go until they really truly come to something and say, okay, that one goes live. And actually, all the slices before that were trying to entice the person who makes the decision, like, you want to go live with this one? You want to go live with this version? You want to go live with that version? So that's really where it goes. And indeed, yes, you get into this hierarchical structure because within the story map, you already have 3 levels, right? You have the stories, then you have you could say the header of the slice, which is the next level up. And then the whole story map in itself is right. Is a bigger thing is also like, is the next level up again. And so I tend to build up my stories in these tree structures. And I really truly believe that, you know, all backlogs nowadays in large organizations are tree structures of backlog items going into higher level backlog items, going into higher level backlog items. But I always, you know, when I tell anybody in the tool, at every level, the template for this thing should be exactly the same because they're always user stories. Because fundamentally in Epic, what is it other than a user story that's too big, right? That's all it is. And people make a whole...
Yeah, it will always have value. Right. It will always have someone it's for, right?
Yeah, at the lower level, I mean, really at the lower level, look, if you talk about business value, I tend to then talk about externally visible deltas, right? That's one of those, again, I guess another viewpoint of mine. That people tend to do the distinction between definition of done and user stories, they do it wrong because people always say functional is user stories and non-functional is definition of done, which makes no sense because the true distinction is deltas. I call them deltas and constraints because, for instance, a non-technical thing like performance or a non-functional thing like performance. What if you want to improve your performance, like your web page is too slow or whatever, and you want to improve the performance from 10 seconds to 2 seconds response time? That's a delta. That goes on the backlog, even though it's non-functional.
Yeah.
But if you want to say, whenever we deliver, the system shall always respond within 2 seconds, that's a constraint. That goes on the backlog, on the definition of done. Functional, the same. So if there is a functional change, let's put a button on the screen, backlog. It's a delta. Thou shalt comply with the user UX guidelines of the company. That's a constraint, definition of done, right? So that's the real distinction between the two. So looking at that at the lowest level is that oftentimes, especially if you cut across, like if you kind of tying back this into the story mapping story, my experience at least is that true business value only comes when you finish the slice. Which could be one story, which could be 4 stories, a number of them. But the true business value only comes at the higher level you call the slice. I tend to call them feature versions. Now I don't even care about the name because you know they're fundamentally a tree structure, and I don't care about the names really. But so that's always why I call the lowest level the user stories, just externally visible deltas, right? So you want to be able to test it, to look at it. It must make some sense that you changed it. But true value only comes in a story map with a full slice.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's just the way I look at these things. Yeah.
So I guess I'll take us on another tact, because we were having a conversation before we turned on the recording.
Yeah.
And we were talking about scaling, which is everybody's favorite conversation.
Oh, is it?
But I was very interested in your thoughts around scaling, because you've obviously had something to do with that.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about what you were talking about in terms of the scaling mechanisms that are available out there and their suitability.
Yeah, what religion do you align with?
What religion?
I was skirting around that, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, I have a tweetable framework of my own. Like I have just two rules. Number one is autonomy over coordination. Because in my view, reducing complexity, and this is actually a lesson we learned from software architecture, right? This is kind of, in some ways I said, even though I am an agile coach, I've never stopped being an architect, because a lot of things I learned from how to make software modular, how to make it independent, how to make it less complex. And that's actually one of the problems I see in many organizations, is they're over complex because they don't apply those principles we've learned from software architecture. And if you look at what truly makes software architecture modules, you know, work and independent and reduce complexity, it's all about autonomy. Can I kind of independently change this thing compared to the other? What are the crosslinks? Like, we have these rules like high cohesion, low coupling, right? Things like that. And this is one of my core rules. So, and actually I'm in an assignment right now as well for a large publisher where you really see this in action. Every team is kind of depending on every other team. And there is a thought experiment that is by a man named Roger Sessions, and Roger Sessions has like an architecture framework, and he has a very interesting like mental model based on exercise metaphor based on dice. So he says, well, complexity could be modeled by using dice. Like, all the states of the dice and all the combinations of the dice are a model for complexity. So if you have 12 dice, that comes out to like 3 billion combinations, something like that. And so if they just also to ask a question to you, if you would have those 12 dice, they make like 3 billion or 3.8 billion combinations. If you cut that into two independent groups of 6 dice, how many combinations do you think are left? You're going from 3.8 billion and just cut it in half. How much do you think are left? How many combinations?
It'll be 6 to the power of 6, right?
Yeah.
You're coming from 6 to the power of 12. You're calculating this too much. Intuitively. I'm asking intuitively. What do you think? Is it like in the million range? Is it in the 5 million range? Is it where? Like
150,000.
150,000. Any other takers?
I think you're still sticking in the billions.
Half a million. So So the answer is 40,000 approximately. You're going from 3.8 to 40,000.
You're closer. You thought too much.
Yeah. If you go into three groups of 4, how many combinations do you think are left? I see these very thinky faces now.
wait. What do you mean 3 groups of 4? As in?
Yeah, 3 groups. So you had 12 dice, and then you split it into 2 groups of 6. And then finally, we split that group up into 3 independent groups of 4.
Right.
Well, since this is a podcast, and of course we don't want the science to stretch out too long, the answer is 3,880 or something, about 4,000, right? So, and this, I think this little metaphor is so counterintuitive to us, the massive, massive, massive effect of autonomy on complexity. It is mind-bogglingly different. Like, if you just take your whole company and you split it into 2, you don't make the company twice as simple to manage. You make it like 1,000 times, 10,000 times easier.
Exponentially better.
It is exponential, indeed. It's massively exponential. So that's also why I say first, when you have a large... So to me, one of the first things in scaling, the rule is go for autonomy first, coordinate what's left. And now to tie in, of course, to the big elephant in the room, safe, right? Is what it does coordination over autonomy. It first says, let's put this big coordination framework on top, and then we'll start figuring other things out. So it basically, I think it goes against the autonomy principle in that sense. It doesn't try to reduce the complexity, so you don't need the framework in the first place. So that's like my first big thing. And the second thing, and that actually goes to what why I personally am a big fan of the Scrum and Scale framework, is because I believe that Scrum is a fractal, or is, you know, it's a recursive thing. It's you know, because a team of teams is a team, and a team of teams is again a team. I believe, fully believe, that if you look at all the principles that apply at the team level with humans, you can apply exactly the same things when you scale at a team of teams level. You can just have a product owner at the team of teams level, a Scrum Master roles, right? Scrum Master, product owner role, Scrum Master role, etc. And you see a bit of that in, for instance, in Spotify, right? Where you see that the tribe lead, which is effectively like a product owner, sort of, and things like that. So, and I think just having those two principles inform a lot of the way I look at frameworks and what I like and don't like about them. And to me, in that sense, SAFe is, if you just pull out some of the weirdness, it's a workable framework, but it has some of these, like one of the bigger things is also, again, in the sense of like the Toyota Kata mindset, like you should always change, you should never like make the framework should always be like geared towards the needs. So you should have better to have a simple framework that you can change and customize to your personal needs for your company than being stuck in the structure. And that's the other big thing I think is also for me important in scaling, is that if you think that you can assume just this one big framework forever, and that's a static structure, you're going against what Agile tries to be, right? You're trying to say, no, at some point, the things we thought were good might not make sense anymore, so we should be able to change. And SAFe, even if the advice in the beginning is good, at some point it will become bad advice, and now what? And I'd rather have an organization that has learned to change itself constantly and not to take all the rules too seriously than one that says, them's the rules. And I recently heard somebody from the States, I had a talk with them, and they said that there's this whole new generation of consultants coming up who have only ever known SAFe. And they have this very Agile is SAFe and them's the rules and this should always be the same. So it's exactly this. And actually, I guess that's the critique. And also those people get very frustrated with us old people, you know, who've been for a while and said like, you know, yeah, you don't get it. I understand that, right? I mean, I understand the fact that they're learning this framework, doing their best, and they have this whole group of people go like, ah, you're idiots. You know, so, yeah, that must be frustrating.
But it's also how it used to be as well. We had a lot of people who were just Scrum advocates and only knew Scrum.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you have to take time to educate them where it came from. Because I think, you know, when I've come across those particular kinds, is taking a moment in time to say, okay, well, maybe we need to take a step back and go back to where Agile came from and actually talk through it. And when they actually see that, you can see the light bulbs going on and the challenges in their minds to go, oh, where are we at now?
Yeah.
And I was going to say, have you seen any organizations get off their gateway drug of SAFe? So people have moved forward.
Yes, but you know what? I mean, I don't even mind SAFe that much because there's many large organizations where, to be honest, if SAFe is the only thing they'll do to move towards Agile, I'll take it. And I know it's not maybe the popular opinion in that sense, but
it's a start.
I know, yeah, it's a start, and I know, especially if I'm involved personally or my company or whatever, I know I can tweak it into a version that works, where the biggest mistakes are being, and I teach them, like, you know, don't use this. Though, like, just an example. It used to be in the olden days that they had the HIP sprints, right? Hardening innovation planning. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I immediately, like, you know, I bristled about is the fact this whole hardening thing. The fact that you give yourself this excuse to kind of push all the gunk under the carpet, and then you wait until the HIP sprint where then you go hardening, quote unquote, which effectively meant, I mean, I saw just people just ramming out functionality for the first four sprints, and then the fifth sprint, there was no innovation. There was a bit of planning, and it was mostly just, you know, clearing up the gunk they created in the first four. And I said, look, this is a very dysfunctional way. So I was at TomTom at the time, and kind of being sent all over the world to kind of assist them. And I kept saying that to them, look, you know, don't take the hardening too seriously. Make sure you don't use it as an excuse to kind of, you know, push stuff under the rug, etc. But it was my experience that, you know, enabled me to warn them for this pitfall. And then they took it to heart, right? So I think if you know what you're doing and you know where the pitfalls are and what the danger signs are and things you should change, then you can make it work in the beginning. And I do believe that if people truly understand the Agile principles, they will at some point move away from whatever version of SAFe they had. I think what is counter to that, what I really don't like about initial implementation is that by then, a whole lot of roles and functions and things will have been embedded in the culture, right? The RTE and the other products. There's all these roles that will have been embedded into the culture. And it might be difficult to get rid of that. So, you know, preferable. If I can, I'll keep them away from it. If I can't, I'll go with the flow and make sure they get the best implementation they can. So just that's the way I look at it.
So you obviously in your time, particularly at Zebia, work with a lot of different organizations over that time. You've mentioned the INGs and the TomToms, yeah, and some of those along the way. I'm just interested in what you've seen, particularly in that part of the world. People hold up a light to ING, you know, for lots of different reasons, and I think one of the successes is that they at least shared their journey. But what's your thoughts? What are the organizations that you see are doing this well, and what is it about them that that makes them do it well?
In the Netherlands, I really like the implementation I was involved in with Bol.com. And Bol.com is, I don't know if you don't know it, it's like the Dutch Amazon.com. They're mm-hmm. the biggest, you know, they're basically the big competitor in the Netherlands. The reason Amazon isn't that well or doesn't have that much market penetration in the Netherlands is because of Bol.com. And we have some other Coolblue and other companies. But Bol.com is one I was involved with. So I was involved with their Agile transition in 2009. And them I really respected because what they did right was that the directors, they said, we had this speed. We used to have this speed, you know, when we started and it was fast and everybody was sitting together and we would just, and now we did 1.5 years. We did this whole framework change. All IT is tired. Where they are the lowest, they have the lowest, job satisfaction of the whole company. They're being pressured all the time. And only now can we really get started. Business is frustrated. You know, we got to do something. And what I really liked about their implementation is that they did it, and this is the only like big bang implementation I was personally part of that worked, because it was at that time, and was it super, super large? No, it was 8 teams at the time. That was the pure IT teams was 8 teams, and then all the people around them. So there were like the business people and some others and a supporting structure, etc. So there was more people involved. But fundamentally, we started with 8 teams at the same time. So what they did right was they invested already beforehand in a general sense in changing the mindset of people to be able to accept change easily. So just irregardless of Agile, they already wanted people to have a flexible mindset and to be able to change, you know, for whatever reason. Like not Agile, but if they had to change a business process or just change for whatever. So they already did courses and things like that to kind of get people into a better mindset around change and how to deal with it. So that was a good thing. The other thing was that I think the directors there truly cared about like the job satisfaction and being fast and really looking at like what is this take? And then being able to say, burning platform, we're all, you know, taking a hard right, go, and then just fully implement it. And so we all went, like, and so we, everybody was trained, everybody was set up. There was a lot of preparation being done around who's going to be in what team. So that was all kind of negotiated. And then it was the 19th of January, I think. They basically turned on the switch and everybody started working in Scrum immediately. So that had the advantage of having less of this, you know, if you only have a single team, then it's really rubs against the rest of the organization. And here that was less the case because the whole organization changed. So that was a big advantage. And they've been driving a very, very, you know, effective Scrum ever since. I was involved with them for 2 years and kind of helped them through like the first phase. And then later when they did the big portfolio planning stuff, was the first time I used portfolio walls, like, you know, big walls with stickies and stuff, like to plan around the teams. That was the first time I did it in 2010. And then they went off on their own, and now they have like their own versions of things. For instance, they have a variant of Holacracy they call Spark, I believe, where they have this blend of things and they use that more in their business teams. So they've actually been very good with coming up with their own versions of processes and customizing it. And of course, not with like with every company, all right? They're definitely not perfect. I mean, one of my colleagues is there now to kind of take one of the other programs and help it and tweak it a bit. As you scale, things get more difficult. But that's actually one of the other implementations I respect a lot. They've done some really cool stuff. And I think in general, in the Netherlands, Agile and Scrum tends to be a good fit because it fits the leadership culture that we have. Leaders in our case tend to be not that hierarchical, you know, in general, like when you have a Dutch employee and you tell them do this and they'll go like, sure, why? Right. We tend to talk back a lot more.
Naturally empowered and autonomous people.
Yeah. So there's, and of course, this is not like we're super people in Agile or something, but there's a bit more of alignment between what the Agile culture wants to be and what the Dutch already are. And I think other like similar cultures to that. So yeah, I think that's one implementation I've really respected. And as far as some other large ones, TomTom has done, they've done that. I was involved with them and they did a Safe implementation. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the ones I was fixing, right? So I was basically pulling things out and like, changing things and making sure they understood why, et cetera. So I think that changed into a workable implementation. And there's been more, Rabobank, other banks have been doing it. So I think I still expect like the whole world to be Agile by now. And then I come up to companies who you still have to explain what Agile is, right? So I keep getting surprised by, I guess, because you're so deep into this thing, that you're surprised the fact that not the whole world knows it yet. So I think there's still a lot of implementation that need to be made. We're not there yet.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Serge. It's been greatly appreciated. If anything, we've learnt that my fellow podcasters, along with myself, can't do simple maths. Which is hilarious.
We didn't sign up for maths on a Friday afternoon after a long week, right?
So if our listeners would like to get in contact with you, Serge, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Sure. My email address is sbeaumont@xebia.com. That's the channel I look at the most. Like my emails tends to be my main channel. Cool.
We'll put that in the show notes. Yeah, and anything else that you'd like to quickly plug?
No.
Great webinars. You don't want to plug them?
Oh, yeah. That's true. Yeah, I'm getting those webinars. Yeah, so I did a webinar on how to do like cross-team coordination in these like all remote times now. That thing is up for download. Also on the Xebia website. But the one that's coming up is going to be me doing my burnout talk and basically telling my story. And it's been actually part of the Xebia curriculum for new consultants. I give them a day of training on consultancy just to make sure that there's a certain level and some basics are in there. And part of that is my burnout story. And it's kind of like an inoculation because like, just a very short summary of that is that if you, you'll never recognize it in yourself. That's one of the things, like, if you didn't you see it coming? No, that's the whole point, right? That's one of those things. So I try to teach people about the burnout, what the story is through my own story, what it is, how you recognize it, what the core, the things at work are, and what you can do about it. With the final message at the end is, since nobody who will get it will see it coming, you have to help each other. So I try to kind of inoculate the whole organization as much as possible so we can look out for each other. And that's kind of the gist of it. And I'll be talking about that soon, I think 25th.
Very important at these times where everyone's dealing with a lot of stress and anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll be using strange terms, very non-scientific terms, like the microwave problem and things like that.
So as per normal, if anyone wants to get in contact with me, you can reach me at Renee@theagilerevolution.com. You can also reach Tony at Tony@theagilerevolution.com and Craig at Craig@theagilerevolution.com. And to sign out, Serge, normally we collectively say our closing speech together. Our closing quote is Viva la Revolution. Ah. Are you willing to join us in that call out?
Oh, yes.
Awesome. On the count of three, one, two, three, viva.
Viva la Revolution.
La Revolution. Yay.
Thank you, Serge.
You're welcome.